Our next case is Cavo Solutions v. Kingston Technology, 2021-1834. Good morning, Mr. Polanco.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Michael Polanco with Fish and Richardson on behalf of Kingston Technology. Before starting, I just wanted to thank the Court and the Court staff for allowing me to appear virtually today. I was very much looking forward to appearing in person before Your Honors. I was unable to do so due to a COVID incident, and I truly appreciate the Court accommodating me so that I was still able to present for Kingston in this format. Your Honors, this appeal raises four main issues, two on liability and two on damages. I'd like to spend my time this morning focusing on one of the liability issues and the two damages. And I'll start with a liability issue that is a legal issue and one that is dispositive of not only this appeal, but the entire case. And that's the district court's redrafting of the claim term, pivoting the case with respect to the main memory, flash memory main body. The district court exceeded its narrow and limited power to correct claims by enacting a wholesale modification of the claim language, substituting the claim term case with the term cover. Now, Your Honor, there is no dispute in this case that case and cover are distinct and separate components as described by the patent. And this was not a permissible correction, but instead a fundamental redrafting of the claims.
But counsel, if one looks at the patent, we see many instances where it's clear that the cover is rotatable, and isn't that the same as pivoting, rotating? And so it seems fairly clear from looking at the patent specification that it was an inadvertent error.
A few points in response, Your Honor. Yes, we acknowledge that in the patent there are preferred embodiments show the cover pivoting or rotating. Of course, the patent is not limited to its preferred embodiments, but even putting that aside, just look at what the court said in its Novo decision. The court there said that the district courts, or courts generally, are only permitted to correct obvious and minor errors. So I think Your Honor's point goes to whether the error, the purported error, is obvious. We would argue it's not, but even if it were, it's not a minor error. This is a wholesale modification, taking one structural component and replacing it with another. That's beyond what this court has permitted in any case that has come before.
Well, why isn't it? This is Judge Proust. Why isn't it minor in the sense that if it's obvious, and therefore every person would have read this and understood that they meant cover and not case, why doesn't that make it a minor change? It seems to me one could arguably say that those two standards, minor and obvious, kind of go together or complement each other. So minor in the abstract, I don't know, but minor once you establish that this was an obvious, on the face of the patent, that this was obviously what they meant, then why isn't that sufficient to say it meets the minor test as well?
A few points in response to that, Judge Prost. First, we would argue that obvious and minor are separate requirements, but even if they are related, as Your Honor knows, we should look at what the PTAB did here. What the PTAB did, when PABO went to the PTAB during IPR and asked for a certificate of correction, the PTAB denied it, and that the reason, I think, is very important. They said that the correction would result in a, quote, moving target. And so what the board recognized is that this change would fundamentally change what the patent covered and what it claimed.
Well, I think, actually, can I just ask for clarification? Did they say it would result in a moving target or it could result in a moving target? I don't know if that's a dispositive difference, but I think you said would, and I think they said could.
I think you're right on that, Judge Prost. I think they said it could result in a moving target. It could lead to a moving target. This is Appendix 1.1.
And what does that mean to you? What do you understand that to mean, that it could result in a moving target?
What we understand that to mean is... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Judge Prost.
No, I was done. Thank you.
We understand that to mean that the board recognized that this was not a minor change, that this was a change that would substantively impact what the claims covered. And I think something that's important...
We don't have any analysis to that, right? I mean, we're speculating a little bit. I mean, if you're pointing us to this patent board decision for its persuasive authority, because that's all it could possibly be for, there's just not a lot there. So I understand what you're trying to use with the patent board decision, but because there really is no there in terms of analysis for us to be persuaded by, I'm afraid you're on your own, or you have to find something else to analogize to give us some way of thinking through this on why what is very apparent to me is an obvious clerical error, and that the correction is likewise very obvious based on reading this very short 3.5 column written description of a rather straightforward invention. Why, nevertheless, this type of error is a major one, not a minor one, and it's so significant that we should understand this judicial correction doctrine as barring this kind of substitution of one word for another.
Thank you for that, Judge Chen, and a few points in response. The first is you suggested that we have to sort of read tea leaves with the board's rejection of the certificate of correction request. What I would point to is the Novo decision, which sets out the standard for judicial correction, says that their correction is not proper if prosecution history suggests a different interpretation. So I think at the very least what we have in the board's rejection of the claim correction request is a suggestion that a correction is not proper, and we even read it to suggest that the correction was...
Let's assume for the moment that Novo is really trying to get at the dialogue between the patent examiner and the patent applicant in the original prosecution that led to the grant of this patent, and whether there was something there to glean from whether there was an understanding there between the relevant parties, the applicant and the examiner, on what is the meaning and scope of this claim. And if you look at the ex parte Quayle action, you will see that the examiner was talking about how he was going to or she was going to allow these claims because of this unique feature of having a hinge element on the case and then another hinge element on the cover, where the two hinge elements of the case and cover are cooperating with each other. So, you know, it doesn't expressly say, and therefore for rotating the cover around the case, but it doesn't take a lot of dots to connect that the examiner was contemplating this, in his or her view, a unique arrangement of a cover that was hingedly coupled to the case for rotating.
And Your Honor, we appreciate that the prosecution history has to be looked at in totality. The IPR becomes a part of that prosecution history, so we don't believe it's only relevant to look at what happened in the original back and forth between the examiner and the applicant. We cited the A-list case for that proposition. I don't believe, I'll let Pablo speak when they get up, I don't believe they disputed that becomes a part of the prosecution history, that therefore is relevant. I think Your Honor suggested that it doesn't take a lot of dots to connect what the examiner said and the claims that issued. I'd submit that it takes even less dots to connect what the board said in IPR and its understanding that this would have been a major change. And one thing I want to point out to Your Honors is what's in the MPEP, because that is what I understand the board would have been applying when it received the certificate of correction. What the MPEP says on this point, of course, it's not binding on this board, but I think it's helpful. This is at section 1481. It says that a change is not of the minor character required for the issuance of a certificate of correction if it would, and this is a quote, materially affect the scope or meaning of the patent. And we submit that clearly here the change that was entered by the district court changed the scope and the meaning of the patent.
Counsel, you wanted to talk about damages as well.
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for that. I'll move on to the first of the two damages points, which is the disclosure of the total accused product revenue by Pavo during trial. In Unilock, this court was clear that disclosure of total revenue to a jury can skew the damages horizon, and once that cat has been let out of the bag, it can never be put back in. Cases like Power Integrations and Laser Dynamics say that total revenue only serves to make the patentee's proper damages amount appear modest by comparison.
Mr. Blanco, is it your understanding of our law that, you know, any reference to total revenue generated by the defendants is just automatic prejudicial error that requires a new trial?
No, that's not our position. We recognize that.
So there has to be some context consideration.
There is context that must be considered, and the context here demonstrates that it was improper. And what I mean by that is there are certain cases, and I believe that CSIRO is one, where the proper damages theory relies on total accused revenue. And there's no way to shield the jury from hearing that. The theory is based on that, and they must hear it. That simply was not the case here.
This is Judge Prost. Sorry to interrupt, but couldn't the jury, given the evidence that was on the record, have figured out the total sales revenue?
Yes, Your Honor, the jury could have pieced it together by pouring through different spreadsheets, but what the way that Pablo presented the total revenue figure during its opening statement in particular was truly troublesome. I'll just quote from the opening statement.
And you didn't object, right? You didn't object to the opening statement, right?
No, Your Honor, we certainly did. So before the opening statement, Pablo had submitted a demonstrative that it was going to use in its opening that included the total revenue. We objected to that. There was a hearing before opening on that in which Judge Staten said the Pavo can't use the slide, but they're free to state the figure. And actually, Judge Staten said that three different times. She said, I'm not going to limit you. This is at Appendix 200.80-84, and in particular, the pin site for what Judge Staten said was 200.84, line 21, until the next page, line 6. And so we objected, we pointed out Unilock, we said this is inappropriate. Going back to Judge Chen's question, it was not related at all to the damages model that was used by Pavo, and it should have been excluded.
Also, Your Honor, there's another point you wanted to make on damages.
And I will quickly, Your Honor, because I see I'm in my rebuttal time, and that is IP Media and Pavo's experts' use of that agreement. Your Honors, that agreement was for a term of 1 cent per unit. That was the payment term. Georgia-Pacific Factor 1 says that you must use the royalties received by a prior licensee if you're going to use that methodology. Mr. Bergman didn't do that. He used a representation that was not payment term, and we would say that that was a methodological error that also did not apportion, and for that reason it should have been set aside. If there are no questions, Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of the time.
Just one real quick question on willfulness.
Yes.
I don't think your theory of why there's no willfulness that you raised on appeal was a theory that you raised below. Is there a pin site that you can point me to that shows me that the theory that because there was a judicial correction required here, as a matter of law, there couldn't possibly be willful infringement? Where did you argue that below?
I can, Your Honor. We argued it in two separate instances. The first is our JMAL brief, and this is at Appendix 1477. We made that argument for why there should have been no finding of willfulness by the jury. We then also argued it in our enhancement brief that there should be no enhancement for willfulness. That brief did not actually make it into the appendix, but you can see in the court's order, and this is at Appendix 1629, the court acknowledges that the argument was made and then rejects it.
We will give you your full 3 minutes of rebuttal back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Wang.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The district court was right in correcting the claims. The point of the invention is a pivoting cover, and correcting the claims from case to cover was self-evident from the claims and consistent with the specification and the prosecution history.
Okay, so where does this fit in our case law? It's not a typographical error, right? Are you saying this is a clerical error?
Your Honor, I would contend that it's both a clerical error and typographical error and consistent with this court's Novo line of cases. I know Novo didn't correct the claim in that case, but Ultimax is a very good case for this particular issue.
That's the comma, right?
Yes, that is the comma dealing with chemical compounds. Kingston tries to dismiss the Ultimax case as just involving a comma, but it is a chemical compound case where commas make a very big deal, and they are different components. Ultimax is really insightful in this case because the Ultimax patent actually involved two certificates of correction, and it was one of those certificates that actually injected the error into the claims. Nevertheless, this court held that judicial correction was appropriate because the error and the correction was obvious. And the same thing applies in this case. Ultimax makes very clear that notwithstanding an amendment, not even withstanding a certificate of correction, that it is within the court's authority to make a correction to an obvious error. And it certainly was an obvious error in this case. The claims themselves are self-evident that there is a mistake here.
Well, did you have an opportunity, or did you think you were obviously aware of this error for a long time because it's so obvious? Everyone who had read the patent would have known that it was an error, right? So wasn't there an opportunity for you before even this board proceeding to come in for a certificate of correction?
Your Honor,
isn't there some obligation on you all to try to correct it and clean it up? Obviously, we could have avoided all of this.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And you know, we didn't understand the error until we became involved with the case, which was many years later. But that sort of policy concern is in some respects at war with the Essex case and the Novo line of cases, which recognize that it is appropriate for courts to make corrections in certain circumstances, and that there are good reasons for not forcing a patentee to use the PTO as the only alternative, because the PTO obviously is prospective only, and that is a significant difference to the term of the patent and the potential damages, and it would have had that effect in this case. And also forcing the patentee to go to the PTO delays proceedings and it multiplies proceedings.
Okay, so here you were at the board, and the board said it would have, what term did the board use, that it would have did a moving target. What does that mean? A moving target suggests that there's something significant or substantive. This is less than minor, because if it was just minor, why would the board have viewed it as a potential moving target?
Your Honor,
they wouldn't say that about a typo, I don't think, or a comma.
Your Honor, I think that there is a lot of speculation as to what the board's statement means. Did it mean moving target in the sense that the substance and merits were going to change, or did it mean a moving target just because of the circumstances and the timing of the proceedings?
Yes, wasn't it a timing issue?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that is the fairest reading of the board's reaction to this, was that they acknowledged that the timing was not great for this request, coming 2 months before the oral hearing. And so I think Kingston is really just packing too much into the board's decision, nor could the board really even do the required analysis. Their analysis is different than the Novo analysis for judicial correction. So really, there's really nothing we can take away from the board's decision in denying that certificate.
Let me ask you about Judge Chen raised the willfulness. Let's assume hypothetically, not this case, but if there were an alleged infringer who looked at the patent, saw this, you know, cover versus case thing, and said and put in writing, well, this is this is not an error, but this is what the patent says, and therefore we don't think we're at risk for infringement because this is what the patent says, and it doesn't make any sense, just like kind of Chef America. What impact would that have on willfulness? Is it your view that if we were to conclude here that this was just a minor change or an obvious change, that that would also absolutely just black letter law not affect or interfere with the willfulness finding under any circumstances?
So, Your Honor, I think that is a very interesting question. First, First, I think that here, because it is an obvious error, that there is nothing that immunizes Kingston from a willful infringement verdict, which is what happened here. Now, if the record were that Kingston actually had documentation or evidence that it did review the patent, saw that it was an error, believed it was an error that could be corrected, then perhaps there would be no basis for the willful infringement finding, but that was not the record here.
Wait, if they saw the error and thought that the error could be corrected, there would be no basis for willfulness finding?
Your Honor, I meant to say if they saw the error and believed it could not be corrected, then they may have the evidence to reverse or not be found in
willful infringement. But how could that be if your view is correct? If it's so obvious, if you want us to conclude that it was so obvious that anyone looking at the face of the patent would have known what it said, then how would it get even if they were just, you know, didn't have their eyes open right? But if it's, if we could, were to conclude that this is so obvious, then how would that dislodge a willful thing, even if in good faith we're right? They looked at it, they said, this doesn't make any sense. We're not worried about this patent and infringing. So that it's giving me a problem because I think the two are in tension.
Well, Your Honor, I think that in a certain circumstance where it is so obvious, they may still be found willfully infringing. However, you know, there is a subjective element to willfulness, right? You know, what did the alleged infringer really believe? And so I can't rule out that there might be a situation where a jury would say they can't be found willfully infringing.
And
here,
it wouldn't be kind of willful blindness if it was a conclusion that it's obvious?
That's the position we would take as the plaintiff, certainly, Your Honor. The record here is not that.
However, maybe there are shades of obvious. Like, there's super, super obvious, and then there's qualifies over the bar obvious, but still maybe a little bit of a closer question of whether it ought to, by the courts, be deemed obvious.
Your Honor, I think it's a really interesting hypothetical. I don't know the right answer. I do think that this is something that would be best served by putting to the jury in those instances.
Is there something you can do to help us understand what kind of principled thinking we should have when it comes to identifying or characterizing whether an error is of a minor sort versus a other kind that is just too significant or major or substantive that it shouldn't be amenable to judicial correction?
Your Honor, I would simply just rely on the Novo line of cases that sets out the test. You know, whether there's reasonable
right,
debate.
Right, but that doesn't really tell us very much so far. And so, you know, we have you here. You've been thinking about this appeal quite a bit. So we need a little help from you. We, at one point, we've already said under Novo that, you know, the type of correction has to be beyond any reasonable debate and the error has to be obvious. But we've also said it has to be an obvious minor typographical or clerical error. And so the question is when you have a circumstance that maybe in one sense the correction looks small, maybe substituting one word for another word, but then it has such a dramatic alteration to the overall claim scope that it then becomes questionable whether it's fair to call it a correction that's just a mere minor one.
Your Honor, maybe I see it a bit differently. I think that when the courts apply the Novo test and they determine that the intrinsic record makes it very clear that there is an error there and makes it very clear what the correction is, then as a result, that correction is deemed minor and not a major change. If there's some doubt about how it should be corrected, potentially there are alternative possible corrections, then it becomes something that cannot be changed. And if in that particular circumstance it's considered major, then so be it. But I really think it's the application of the Novo test.
Well, what about Chef America?
Yes, yeah, so Kingston relies on Chef America and Haemonetics for the principle that courts don't redraft claims, whether that be to save it from invalidity or to make it operable. But that is very different than the situation we're facing here, as recognized by Essex and other cases, where if there is an obvious error in the claims...
Wasn't the error in Chef America as obvious, come under the rubric of obvious?
Well, Your Honor, actually, so Chef America, it was obvious that that was what the patentee intended the claim to say, and there was nothing inconsistent in the claim language or in the specification or in the prosecution history that suggested a different interpretation, nothing that supported what the patentee was proposing in that case. And so Chef America said the claims here are unambiguous, and it expressly distinguished Chef America from the judicial correction cases, and even cited Novo. And the major distinction there was that in Chef America, there was no ambiguity about the claim, and there was nothing inconsistent with the record.
And the patent owner didn't seek judicial correction.
That's right. And Chef America, the court there expressly stated the patentee here didn't seek correction at the PTO or at the district court, or even assert that this language was an error. The problem was simply that it, you know, in practice, it led to dough that would be burnt to a crisp. Nevertheless, that's what the claim said, and there was nothing inconsistent with that in the intrinsic record.
Well, is there a difference? Is there a legal distinction between seeking judicial correction or just saying this, making the same exact subject arguments that you make in Novo, but putting it under the rubric of claim construction or in-depth, you know, something else, and not judicial correction? I mean, why would that make a difference?
You know, maybe the analysis at the end of the day is the same, Your Honor, but by not asking for judicial correction, you know, it's a bit of a tell that you didn't consider this or you don't view this as an inadvertent
error. Well, one could say the
error.
Same thing about you not having gone to the board beforehand or at some point back to the patent office and saying, you had plenty of time, years beforehand, and saying, we need a correction on this. I mean, I guess I'm just not understanding why seeking a judicial correction, not having gone back to the board or the PTO for correction, somehow counts for you, as opposed to what happened in Chef America.
Is that something a potential infringer could do? Go back to the patent office and correct it?
I'm not sure if...
I meant the patent owner.
Yes, the patent owner could, of course, go back to the patent office and request a certificate of correction. But with that, there are significant downsides. The patent office only does prospective, and so you'd be giving a lot of the damages carried away.
Is there anything in the case law that suggests there's a forfeiture component to judicial correction or a certificate of correction avenue back to the PTO, where if you've waited too long and it's been out there for so long with this mistake, this error, this defect, it's just too stale for you to try to save it at the end of the day?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case or any authority that suggests that.
But wait a minute, but you just suggested, and you know these patent procedures better than I probably, but if you had gone to the, there was a disincentive for you to go to the PTO and get a correction sooner rather than later, because then your rights would be limited just being prospective. So there's a significant advantage to waiting and getting a judicial correction of an obvious error because of that disincentive, I guess.
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that suggests that the patentee here sat on its rights and for purposes of avoiding...
No, but is that right is a matter of the way the process works? Am I you suggested it.
No, Your Honor, I think you're right. I mean, you know, there are significant drawbacks that people are aware of if you seek a certificate of correction at the PTO. But there is no authority that I'm aware of that says that there's some sort of time limit. And I can only point you back to the Ultimax case, where in that case there were not one but two certificates of correction. And yet, when this issue finally surfaced at the court, they still made the judicial correction because the error was obvious. And sometimes,
well, why would the board have that proceed, the PTO? I mean, do we have cases on that? That if you get a certificate of correction at the patent office, it only applies prospectively. In other words, retroactively, there's no correction and the uncorrected patent stands for purposes of damages or whatever.
Your Honor, Novo discusses that actually, and it acknowledges that the PTO correction is just prospective only. And it did that because it was discussing the difference between the avenue of PTO correction versus judicial correction. And also acknowledged that Congress, in enacting those statutes, didn't overrule Essex or mean to take away the authority of the court's judicial.
Well, okay, well, I'm just asking you hypothetically. If we were to look at, obviously none of this is written by Congress, it's judicial. But if Congress were to look at this, would there be a basis for which Congress would distinguish between those two corrections and make one so much more, arguably broader in the, if you seek judicial correction than if you go to the PTO? Can you think of a policy reason the Congress would have distinguished between those two?
Your Honor, I can't, but I can tell you that that Congress has looked at that. And when it enacted Section 255, Essex was already on the books. And Novo acknowledged, looking through that legislative history, that there was nothing that indicated that Congress intended to change it. One thing I think that is important for judicial correction is it sort of acknowledges this principle that, to err is human and to forgive divine. And when you are looking at an error, oftentimes what you see is being confused by what your brain expects, and that happens because your brain is expecting what it understands and what it intends. And that, I think, is consistent with what happened in this record. Everyone understood what the claim was meant to cover, and they didn't catch this error, unfortunately, until much later, and no case law precludes that later judicial correction by Judge Staten.
I know you're out of your time, but could you just explain and distinguish away the Rembrandt opinion, where this court found there was no judicial correction that was going to be allowed there to permit the addition of the transmitter section term into the claim?
In that case, Your Honor, the claim was written.
We called it a substantively significant change or something like that.
That's right. And it was the claim was written as an apparatus. The problematic limitation was a method step at the end. The patentee had proposed correcting it or adding the language that would make it make that last limitation consistent with the apparatus claim itself. There's not much analysis, unfortunately, in that Rembrandt decision. It simply really kind of just adopts the district court's determination that was not supported by the record.
So how do you distinguish it then?
I think the result was that there was nothing in the intrinsic record that supported that correction. Everything in the intrinsic record suggested that was what it was intended. And I think that's the that's the distinction between many of these cases, Your Honor. Is it obvious from the intrinsic record that there was an error and what the correction should be? And if so, the courts have the power to correct. Your Honor, I know I'm way past my time.
With permission from the presiding officer, just take please take a minute and just respond to the sales revenue point that your colleague was making.
Yes, Your Honor. So
we have cases that make that a no-no, right?
That is the Unilock case, Your Honor, and there are cases that acknowledge that certain references to information like that are acceptable, like the Vectura case and Syncor. In this instance, there are two main points to that. One is that we know the record suggests that they were not unfairly prejudiced by these three isolated statements to the revenue. The record suggests that they weren't unfairly prejudiced because they didn't ask for a curative instruction, even though Judge Staten specifically told them, if you want me to add anything to the instructions, I'll do so, and yet they didn't take her up on that. She did instruct them on the proper role of the jury in determining the value, and Kingston never filed a 50A or 50B motion on this issue, nor did they ask for a new trial on this issue. In taking that approach, they really deprived Judge Staten of the opportunity to consider the issue fully, to determine if there was a way to ameliorate it, and deprives this court of the full record had she done that. Now, going to the statements themselves, Your Honor, these are three isolated statements. Two statements made in opening. The initial statement was made in the context of rebutting their argument that their non-infringing alternatives would sell just as well. And just a mere minutes after that, I made the second statement. And of course, the jury was told that opening statements are not evidence. The third statement was made by Mr. Bergman, also in the context of rebutting their non-infringing arguments, non-infringing alternatives
okay.
arguments.
I don't want to labor it.
Sure, Your Honor. If I may conclude, Judge Lurie.
Conclude, yes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So Judge Staten's rulings were correct, and her management of this case should be lauded, not derided, as Kingston does in the briefs. The correction here was obvious. Kingston's machinations are divorced from the intrinsic record and purely flawed extrinsic evidence. And damages decisions of Judge Dane were not an abuse of discretion. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Wang. Mr. Blanco, you may take 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I want to go to a few things that were raised by Mr. Wang in his judicial correction argument. One thing that Judge Prost, you had asked a few questions asking whether Pavo and its predecessors had an opportunity before to address this purported error. They certainly did, and what's telling is right after the patent issued in 2006, Pavo's predecessor sought and received a certificate of correction that corrected 9 different errors or purported errors in the patent. So Pavo's predecessor had the ability to actually exercise that ability, and it didn't recognize or chose not to. I don't want to assign motive to address this cover case issue. So we have that. I agree, Judge Prost, with your suggestion that whether or not the patentee frames their request as one for judicial correction should not control the court's analysis. We don't believe that's what happened in Chef America, but even putting that aside, in Haemonetics, it was acknowledged by the patentee that there was a potential error in the claims. So,
could this change have been remedied by a reissue application?
I'm not sure that it could have, Your Honor. I believe
claiming more or less than he had a right to claim? But then wouldn't there have been intervening rights?
I believe that would have been the case, Your Honor, because this changed the scope of the patent, and so any reissue would have had intervening rights for what was not covered before that was then covered by the broader reissue patent. And again, going back to what the office looks at when it looks at a correction under 255, it does not permit a correction for anything that would materially affect the scope or meaning of the patent. I think it's significant because Mr. Wang pointed to Novo. He said that Novo didn't mean to upset any of the law that had been put in place by Essex. But what Novo recognizes and says quite clearly is that the office's power to correct claims is greater than that of the district court.
What about the Supreme Court's Essex opinion itself from 100 years ago, where there was a judicial correction there that did alter the scope of the claim, and it changed the limitation for a lift edge for that heel insert to require a rear lift edge or something like that. And so therefore it did alter the scope of the claim in a structural sense.
And Your Honor, what I would argue is the extent it altered the scope of the claims, it made it narrower. It specified that it wasn't just the upper part of the heel lift, it was the rear upper part. I think there had been a dispute between the parties as to whether the side could clarify. So it made the claim narrower, if anything. We see that also in the other cases.
Why wouldn't that be broadening, actually, where only the rear portion of the edge needed to be above a certain plane as opposed to the entire edge?
I'm not sure I read it that way. I believe it could have read on either the side or the rear before, and with the correction, it altered the scope so that it was only the rear. But one thing I did want to go back to was the Rembrandt case that was brought up by Your Honors at the end of the argument. Don't think that there's a distinction there, and what's important about Rembrandt is actually how it characterizes Ultimax, a case that Pablo relies on quite heavily, and what the applicant or the patentee sought to do in Rembrandt was add a limitation into the independent claims, and the court distinguished Ultimax and said simply adding in a comma is different than this, which is a fundamental redraft. We would argue the same is true here. There was a redraft by changing the structural makeup of the claim limitation. And to close, Your Honors, I would like to just end on this point, which is that there's been discussion about what Pablo could have done, what it couldn't have done, what would have been obvious to Kingston, to not, what the Patent Office said. We would submit that to the extent there's any ambiguity or disagreement on the record, that should fall on Pavo and its predecessors. They were the ones who were at liberty to seek correction, to draft the claims in the initial state, and that should not fall on Kingston, and certainly not as it comes to willfulness, to be found as a willful infringer of a claim that, as literally drafted, there's those who Kingston did not satisfy. With that, Your Honors, I appreciate the time, and thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the arguments of both counsel, and the case is taken under submission.